It is 8:30. We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish, co-editor of Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Back with us from your travels to the Deep South.
Yes, it was a great time.
Excellent.
But hot and humid. I like the weather up here a lot better.
Yeah.
Especially in the summer.
I hear that. All right, well, let's start with Olympia, the state's capital. They have...
Yes, and Olympia got a lot of national attention in the last couple weeks, in the last week especially, because of the protests at the port of Olympia, where a cargo ship with some Stryker tanks and various other paraphernalia due to go to Iraq was being loaded at the port, and a number of anti-war activists, primarily from Evergreen but also from the community, did a number of demonstrations there, including several rounds of civil disobedience, and got quite a bit of attention for it. About only about three dozen people total were arrested over the course of about a week, but it got an enormous amount of attention, which you know, suggests that those kind of tactics again, you know, it's probably about time to consider them in other parts of the country and even in other parts of the Puget Sound region as well. Of course, we saw that not much happened when folks tried to sit in at Maria Cantwell's office about a month and a half ago in terms of media attention. But there are plenty of Iraq war-related businesses and military bases and various other outlets in the Puget Sound region, and you know, it really did suggest that a relative handful of committed people can accomplish quite a bit. The folks in Olympia got a lot of attention, not only for their own activism, but for the you know, some of the more hidden ways in which the Iraq War is supported here at home. So good for them.
All right. Moving along, the Washington State Board of Pharmacy made a decision this week that...
Yeah, and it was splashed across the front pages of both the... Actually, above the fold on the front page of both the Times and the PI on... I guess it was yesterday, wasn't it? The actual pharmacy board policy doesn't appear to be too much different than a draft policy that came out about a month ago that... really made it fairly difficult for pharmacists to refuse for quote unquote reasons of conscience to dispense a particular prescription. The difference between the draft proposal and the one that has been recommended by the pharmacy board, and there's still it's just a recommendation. There's still a public comment period, so you know, have at it if you're upset about this. But the difference primarily seems to be that with the original proposal, you could, as a pharmacist, only refuse to fill a prescription if there were another pharmacist on site or, you know, readily at hand that could fill the prescription instead, and you had to have make your moral concerns known to your employer, to the pharmacy, your hospital, or whatever it is, ahead of time, so that they could make arrangements to refer customers to other pharmacists or you know, have other pharmacists on hand if it's a large enough pharmacy that could fill the prescription. Well, the language for the new draft of this recommendation is it's a little bit different. Says that pharmacy ancillary personnel shall not obstruct a patient in obtaining a lawfully prescribed drug or device. The phrase "shall not obstruct" implies that the patient has to or the customer has to be able to get the prescribed drug or device, you know, from the pharmacy or in some other way. But it doesn't spell it out, and that's what's concerning a lot of people, particularly Planned Parenthood and also Christine Gregoire. For whatever reason, I don't know if it was political pressure or whatnot, the pharmacy board seems to have backpedaled a little bit. That's not good news. But we're still talking about a situation that has, number one, not arisen very much at all in Washington State. It's been a pretty uncommon situation. And number two, a lot of the concern is over Plan B, And at least nationally, and I don't even know when the timing of any incidents here in Washington State have been, but in terms of the national trend, those kind of refusals by pharmacists who had concerns about particularly about abortion and you know the life of the unborn child, et cetera, those came very much in the early days of Plan B when it wasn't clear to some of those folks how Plan B worked, because it doesn't work the same way as some of the other things of as abortion. It's not a fertilized egg that they're just planting. So as the information about how Plan B works has spread, it's become less and less common that people have these refusals to dispense for reasons of conscience. That being said, it is a recommendation. There is a public comment period, and there should be a much more clear cut and straightforward requirement as. You know, there already is under law that if somebody has a legal prescription, that they should be able to get it filled.
All right. Moving along, school closures is something that is also getting a lot of headline attention here in Seattle.
Yeah, and there's been an interesting backlash, particularly from the Seattle Times and, for that matter, also because of this website that's come out at the same time that the school district is getting a lot of flack over for its definition of racism and institutional racism and so forth. But my own boss's boss at Seattle Weekly, Knute Berger, had a column on it, which I wasn't entirely thrilled about in this week's Weekly. There seems to be a real backlash against critics of the school closure list and the list that Raj Manas, the superintendent, came out with yesterday, virtually unchanged from the Citizens Committee recommendations, except that Sacagawea in the North End is going to be saved and another new school in the South End is going to be moved. The reality is that the vast majority, something like 11 out of the 16 of the schools that are being affected by these moves or closures are 8 out of the 9 that are being closed was the statistic have majority non-white student populations, and 11 out of the 16 overall that are being affected are south of the Ship Canal, and that was before Sacagawea was taken off the list. So I mean there is a racial disparity in the way this is playing out, and there's also a disparity, as I mentioned in this program a couple weeks ago, in the way that alternative programs are being affected. The Montessori and the TOPS program and some of the other the John Marshall Alternative High School, the Summit K through 12 is being moved. All of these different programs that are relatively small but relatively successful in not only in targeting particular student populations but in helping students who don't learn as effectively in traditional ways of teaching, which basically at this point means cramming for the WASL test. Some kids just have other ways of learning rather than sitting down and memorizing. I know I did. And so this is still a deeply problematic closure list, and we're going to see a lot more activism on this by particularly the parent and teacher groups from affected schools, but really from all over the district, between now and when the school board makes their final decision on July 26th.
All right. And finally, locally, the Department of Homeland Security is making cutbacks here, both locally and to cities across the country.
Yeah. The overall amount of money that's being allocated in fiscal year 2000, this upcoming fiscal year, by the federal government for anti-terrorism prevention is being cut back. And go figure. And not only is it being cut back, but it's being cut back most in the cities that need it most. New York is seeing a 40% cut. Washington, D.C. is seeing a major cut. And not only that, but Homeland Security determined that there were no major targets of interest for terrorists in the District of Columbia, which is kind of remarkable because the entire District of Columbia is a terrorist target. Also, Seattle is being cut back. Meanwhile, cities that happen to be in swing states or red states, check out some of the cities that are getting more than Seattle. Seattle is. Well, Portland's getting more, which is kind of a surprise. Not so much because, you know, I mean, Portland's becoming a large city, but it doesn't really have any large landmarks of national note. Its port is not nearly as large as Seattle's is. There's no ferry system there, et cetera, et cetera. But you're also looking at places like Fort Lauderdale getting more money than Seattle. Jacksonville, Florida. In fact, four cities in Florida are getting more than Seattle, and another one, Tampa, is nearly there and is getting a raise. Charlotte is getting more money this year. Omaha is getting more money this year. Milwaukee is getting more money this year. I mean, you can just go down the list of cities that I think Seattle ranks something like 22nd in the country, even though you can make a case that it's among the top seven or eight cities in the country that are terrorist targets, and has been one of the few in the country that actually was the focus of a terrorist plot at one point. So it really is kind of inexplicable. Now, legislators, particularly from New York and D.C., are pledging to hold hearings. They're objecting in Congress about this. It's an open question as to what kind of advocacy is going to happen around here. Unfortunately, Seattle's Congressman Jim McDermott not only doesn't carry much sway in the House of Representatives, but he's also not very good at or very interested in funneling federal money into King County and the city of Seattle. So that's probably not as much of an option, but it is really a bewildering kind of choice, and it underscores once again how with Homeland Security, which don't forget is also responsible for disaster preparedness, and we're waiting for the next big quake as well, and they did such a bang up job in New Orleans, we just have a federal government that is not meeting its responsibilities in that regard. And in terms of the city of Seattle's preparedness, we got to take some of our own responsibility for this, because we're not getting the help we need from the feds.
All right. Well, sticking with the theme of Homeland Security, Alberto Gonzalez is looking at getting ISPs to cough up some more info.
Yeah, he and FBI Director Robert Mueller, the civil libertarian's best friend, have, according to USA Today on Thursday, put in requests to Google, Microsoft, AOL, Comcast, Verizon, various other ISPs to save for up to 2 years the click-by-click records of every time you go onto the web and surf the web. The federal government wants those records. And the question, of course, is why? And what's it going to do with that? And, what kind of use is going to be made out of that? We have no idea. Again, one more very worrisome invasion of privacy rights. Now, of course, I think it's been a truism for a long time on the internet that there's no such thing as privacy, and the government can monitor whatever it wants. But coming out directly with this and implying that the government is not only potentially monitoring things like this, but storing them in databases and being able to go back and track the activities of individuals, every individual in the country, everyone with an email account, cross-referencing that with personal information that's also available through government records on the web. It's a very, very frightening scenario. And if you remember the Total Information Awareness Program, the John Poindexter thing that was so controversial and shot down when it was floated out about 3 or 4 years ago by the Pentagon, we're moving in that direction. It's the same thing by another name. The federal government wants to compile a database of everything there is to know about you. And we're heading in that direction. This is another step.
All right. Well, speaking about heading in that direction, the two places that we've been getting a lot of information about what's really going on in our government are from, reporters for what little they do. But whistleblowers have figured into that prominently.
Yes. And whistleblowers, particularly in the government itself. And unfortunately, there was a case that came before the Supreme Court that was ruled on this last week involving a local government whistleblower in Los Angeles. But it was a precedent that involved the right of government employees at any level to sue when their bosses in the government retaliate against them for trying to either expose or put a stop to illegal and immoral behavior. And naturally, the The Supreme Court voted 5-4 with Mr. Alito being the swing fifth vote that that whistleblowers have no such rights. It's going to be much more difficult now for them to make a case of retaliation against against the government and sue the government. So they have lost an essential legal protection is the right word, but a legal right to be able to you know, something that that dissuaded a lot of government, you know, political appointees and so forth from retaliating against against whistleblowers. This has been an administration that's been very hostile toward whistleblowers, of course, and now that's been backed up by the Supreme Court. Once again, it is the first of what is likely to be a number of bad fruits that will be borne by the approval of Samuel Alito to the Supreme Court for a lifetime appointment. We're just starting to see what that's going to look like.
So while the government is pursuing extracting more and more info from its citizens, John Negroponte...
With tweezers, I might add, yeah.
If you're lucky.
Yeah.
John Negroponte made a move to reduce the amount of information that comes forward from... contractors, government contractors.
Yeah, this should be a huge story, and I don't know why it's not. And particularly when it comes, you know, at virtually the same time as the verdicts in the Enron deal, because you're, you know, you're talking about corporate malfeasance, you're talking about relatively weak reforms that were made in corporate accounting procedures in the wake of Enron, and the fact that corporate scandals are still occurring, et cetera, et cetera. This didn't even get any attention at all outside the business press. There was an article in Business Week and some other folks picked it up and that was about it. But John Negroponte was given the right by President Bush to suspend reporting requirements to the SEC for any government contractor for national security or anti-terrorism work or military contracting that he chooses, which is, you know, about two-thirds of the Fortune 500. If you sit down and look at it, you know, who's got government contracts? They spread it around. So basically, a huge chunk of the American economy has just been you know, given the possibility of being exempted from SEC reporting requirements. All they have to do is to get the go-ahead from John Negroponte, an appointed political official. Now, interestingly enough, this decision was made this order was taken by Bush in the days immediately before it was revealed that Bell South and Verizon and AT&T getting paid by the federal government to provide, you know, these couple hundred million names for a computer database for the NSA data mining on you know, every call that every American has ever made, being what the government is trying to build. Well, the government is paying for those, and so the speculation is that this huge sweeping edict was made specifically so that those companies wouldn't have to reveal how much money the federal government is paying them in order to get these records. So it really stinks all the way around. But it's a much bigger deal than simply the NSA issue, because it gives the potential of exempting almost any of this country's major transnational corporate players from reporting requirements for the SEC, and that's what guarantees that investors, stock analysts, etc., have accurate information on how a company is performing.
All right. And briefly, the Rolling Stone this week had a significant article about elections in Ohio.
Yeah, came out Thursday night. Check it out. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has there's actually not that much new material in it, but he puts it together very well, very dispassionately. It's not a polemic screed. What it is a very compelling argument that the electoral fraud in the 2004 presidential election, particularly in the state of Ohio, was so widespread that there's virtually no question that John F. Kerry or that John Kerry was the rightful winner of the 2004 election. This article is going to get a lot of buzz. Hopefully, it will bring the whole issue up again and legitimize it a little bit more, since a lot of these allegations have been floating around in alternative media, you know, for the last 18 months. But they haven't really gotten a lot of press in mainstream media. So check it out.
All right, and very briefly, Divine Strike has been called off?
Yes, this is the test that was being planned for the Nevada test site to basically calibrate what size of a nuclear weapon you would need to nuke Iran. And it was had been planned for June 2nd, for yesterday, and then was postponed until at least June 23rd because of a lawsuit by the Winnemucca Indian tribe and others that are downwind from it, claiming that there was no environmental review and the tests weren't safe. Well, now... The agency that is was coordinating the test has postponed it indefinitely, and it looks like it's dead, specifically because of the lawsuit. So this is good news, very good news, that citizen activism was able to stop this test.
All right, jumping to international and Iraq.
A lot happening in Iraq, of course, Haditha being a huge story. The amazing thing, of course, is as Dar Jamal and a number of others have been pointing out, is that reports of mass numbers of civilian deaths at the hands of the U.S. military have been pretty routine over the last 3 years, particularly in Arabic and Middle East media, but they haven't gotten any attention here in the U.S. The fact that Time magazine picked it up and then the U.S. Army then legitimized it with an investigation is making this into a big deal. But we shouldn't be surprised that atrocities happen, particularly in a counterinsurgency war. It's the nature of the beast. And, you know, the whole idea that this somehow undermines the war effort, well, it's already been undermined because it's a complete disaster. You know, there's overwhelming opposition to the war in the United States if you look at the polling. And there's even more widespread opposition to American troop presence if you look at the polling of Iraqis themselves. So, you know, how this is supposed to undermine a war effort that has already resulted in, you know, anywhere from 40 to 200,000 Iraqi civilians having been killed since the invasion happened. And I was lectured by somebody who emailed me after I wrote on this earlier this week, saying that well, the war didn't start in 2003; it started in 91 and has been going ever since then, with the 500,000 plus deaths from economic sanctions. So you can add those in too. With all of those civilian deaths on the U.S. hands, you know, Iraqis are going to be upset about Haditha, but you know, there's already an awful lot of dead civilians out there that are that we're responsible for. You know, a couple dozen more. You know, it's tragic, but it's a drop in the bucket compared to what's already been happening. That said, there was another report that came out on Thursday where the BBC said that it had a video from an incident in March in which 11 people, including five women and four children, five children, four women, were again massacred with gunshot wounds, and then the house set on fire by a place called Ishiki. And remarkably enough, the next day on Friday, the U.S. military in Baghdad rushed out its investigation, where it said everybody was in the clear, no such thing happened. But we're likely to hear more about this one too. And it wouldn't surprise me if some of the other past allegations are going to start floating out around that. And then just on the issue of what democracy has brought to Iraq and who's running the show these days, a number of civilian deaths in Iraq this week. Among the more tragic, the national tennis coach and two of the national team's members were shot down and killed in Iraq or in Baghdad this week for wearing shorts, because fundamentalists object to people wearing shorts. It's considered too Western and too decadent, and that is you know, the sort of umbrella of fear that a lot of people in Iraq are living under these days.
All right, and jumping over to Afghanistan, another conflict that we are taking the lead in.
Yeah, and another nasty incident coming out involving the killing of mass numbers of civilians at a place called Hejiya on May 22nd. The U.S. military had originally announced that it had raided and bombed a village in the mountains of Afghanistan and killed 50 Taliban. Well, it turns out that it didn't kill any Taliban, according to a number of witnesses who fled the region. When the U.S. attacks a village like that, it tries to cordon off the region to prevent survivors from fleeing. In this case, they managed to get out and make their way to hospitals in Kandahar. And what they said uniformly was that the Taliban who were in the area had left as soon as the U.S. approached the area. But what the U.S. did do instead was kill somewhere between 40 and 50 civilians. Again, we're going to hear more about this as well. Extremely bloody week in Afghanistan this week. Riots in Kabul, where a car crash involving a U.S. Army convoy attracted an angry crowd, and U.S. Soldiers fired into the crowd, killing four people. The subsequent riots left another 12 people dead and 130-some wounded. The U.S. presence in Afghanistan is deteriorating as well, and we're going to be hearing more and more about this.
And moving over to Iran.
Yeah, kind of a breakthrough this week. Condoleezza Rice announcing that the Bush administration would be willing to negotiate with Iran as part of the multilateral talks that the European Union powers have already been holding. But they put conditions on it, conditions that they knew that Tehran would reject. They demanded that Tehran, before any talks begin, drop its uranium enrichment program. Well, Iran already did this once when it began its talks with the EU, and those went nowhere for 3 years. It's not going to, and in the meantime, they lost that entire time in terms of developing their program. They're not going to do that again. They've said they wouldn't, and when the offer was made, they again reiterated that was non-negotiable. At the same time, the U.S. also put as a precondition that Russia and China agree in advance to the idea of imposing sanctions through the UN Security Council if Iran was not cooperative in dropping their uranium enrichment program. So this is kind of a non-starter, but at the same time, it was the first time that the Bush administration has indicated any willingness whatsoever to talk with Iran. Particularly notable in the media coverage of this, nowhere in U.S. media coverage that I noticed it was anybody mentioning that Iran themselves has been saying for weeks and weeks, if not a couple months now, that they wanted no-holes-barred bilateral talks directly with the United States. So Tehran has already been making these kind of overtures, which have been rejected by Washington for some time. Instead, this was treated as some sort of a victory by the doves within the Bush administration and a showing of openness by the Bush administration, and not indicating at all that this is something that Iran has already been trying to make happen for some time.
All right, and finally, local events.
A couple coming up. We have, I should mention also, down in Tacoma today. I was down there last night for an Iraqi war film festival, and that's going on at Tacoma Community College again today and tomorrow, starting at 11 o'clock, Building 28, for folks who are down in that part of Puget Sound. Greg Palast is going to be at Elliott Bay Books this coming Thursday evening.
He's going to be at Town Hall.
Town Hall also, okay. Didn't see that one, but he will also be at Elliott Bay. Elliott Bay is putting it on. You're right. It's the Town Hall.
Town Hall, 7:30.
Yes. And
Thursday.
Thursday. And then George Bush, according to reports, is going to be in town on the 2 weeks from yesterday, Friday the 16th of June, in Medina to attend a fundraiser for Dave Reichert. That will, of course, put the lie to to what Reichert's been trying to put out for some time, that he's a moderate who often disagrees with the Bush administration. That's not what his voting record says, and that wouldn't be why Bush is coming to town. But for anybody who is interested in protesting George Bush, we got a couple weeks to pull it together. So, Friday, June 16th, Medina, be there.
Talking once again with Job Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And quickly, where do people find Eat the State?
Comes out every couple of weeks. It's a free newspaper you can find at bookstores and cafes and King County Library System, other places where you find free publications. You can also find us on the web at www.eatthestate.org. All of our current and past issues are up there, the blog, et cetera, et cetera. We take donations, we take comments, we take feedback, we take tips. We take volunteers. If you're interested in any of that, email us or check us out on the web or give our voicemail a call. Area code 206-719-6947.